Hello, and welcome to EG's Annual Cases Review of the Year with Jess Harold and Sarah Jackman. What an interesting year 2018 has been judicially. It's been notable in several areas in particular, not least rating, which has seen practitioners grapple with the ramifications of a steady stream of cases, both from the High Court and the tribunals, dealing with areas as diverse as rates mitigation schemes, procedure, valuation, and expert witness. A number of those cases went as far as the Supreme Court for determination. We've also continued to see cases dealing with the modification of restrictive covenants, most recently in Alexander Devine Children's Cancer Trust versus Millgate Developments, where the developer may be forced to demolish a 23-unit social housing development that was erected in breach of covenant. Developer Millgate is currently seeking permission to appeal to the Supreme Court. Looking ahead to 2019, early on, all eyes will be on Canary Wharf versus the European Medicines Agency, a dispute over whether the EMA will be able to free itself of its lease obligations by arguing that Brexit was an unforeseen event of frustration. But that's next year. Now it's time for the main event, the top 10 cases of 2018, as selected by EG. Kicking us off is a pair of cases that have tied for the number 10 spot. The first, Hewitt VO versus Telereal Trillium, was a Court of Appeal decision determined right at the start of the year, which considered valuation for rating in relation to vacant property at the end of its economic life. It was agreed by both parties that there was no demand for the vacant office building in Blackpool owing to its size, age and location. In rating terms, however, the upper tribunal found that it should still be entered onto the rating list at a sum of £370,000. The ratepayer contended that, as it was accepted that there was no demand for the property, the upper tribunal was wrong to conclude that the hypothetical basis for valuation required the valuer to assume a demand that did not, in reality, exist. The correct value for the appeal property was therefore a nominal figure of rateable value £1. The Court of Appeal agreed, finding that in the real world there was no demand for the property at the relevant date and that the hypothetical basis of valuation for rating did not mean that demand was to be assumed where none existed. Business rates consultant Blake Penfold offers his views on the decision. The second case sharing the number 10 spot is Generator Developments Limited versus Lidl UK, a case from April in which the supermarket chain fended off a claim from a developer that it had joint venture negotiations with prior to buying a near £7 million development site. As Alison Colby summed up the case in her practice point, the question that arose was, did Generator agree to step aside and allow Lidl to purchase a site on the understanding that they would pursue a joint venture and that Generator would obtain an interest in the property once it had been acquired? In essence, it was proposed that Lidl would buy the site and, if Generator succeeded in obtaining planning permission, Lidl would then sell the freehold to Generator. Generator would build a mixed-use development and grant a 999-year lease of a new retail store to Lidl. But the discussions ended soon after Lidl acquired the property. Generator had spent a considerable sum on architects, mechanical and engineering consultants and structural engineers, and its involvement made a material contribution to the success of Lidl's bid. Indeed, the judge at first instance noted that the seller was more likely to accept the joint bid than it would have been if Lidl had made a bid on its own. Even so, the High Court dismissed the claim and the Court of Appeal upheld that decision. Giving judgment to the court, Lord Justice Lewison rejected Developer Generator's appeal, ruling that this was a case of commercial parties advised by lawyers working at arm's length towards the conclusion of an agreement for a purely commercial enterprise, the terms of which were never agreed.
Now for number 9, and in May, the Supreme Court gave its decision in Rock Advertising Limited versus MWB Business Exchange Centres Limited, a case involving no oral modification clauses in contracts, or, as they are appetisingly known for short, NOMs. The court ruled that a NOM in a property licence agreement for Central London office space meant what it said. It overturned an earlier ruling in favour of the occupier, marketing company Rock Advertising, that the clause did not actually forbid subsequent oral variation of the contract. Rock had sought to rely on an alleged oral variation of its licence fee payment arrangements made after falling into arrears. but the Supreme Court judgment has the effect that the landlord is entitled to seek to recover arrears and exclude Rock from the premises in accordance with the terms of the original agreement. Practitioners differed in their response to the decision. Emma Humphreys, partner at Charles Russell Speechleys, welcomed the decision for not opening the floodgates to uncertainty and said that it clarifies the law in this area, giving real meaning and support to nom clauses within contracts. She said that any finding that the nom clause was ineffective would have created the potential for significant uncertainty for contracting parties and those advising them. However, our legal notes contributor, Stuart Pemble, partner at Mills & Reeve, took a different view. In his note headlined, "Why the Supreme Court is Wrong on Nom," he expressed the view that contract law should reflect what actually happens in practice, adding, "If the evidence shows that the parties have varied a contract despite a nom clause, I think it only fair to give effect to that variation."
At 8, a case that dealt with the concept of negotiating damages and was determined by the Supreme Court in April. Its name, Morris Garner versus One Step Support Limited. To quote Lord Reed, it raised an important question in relation to the law of damages. In what circumstances can damages for breach of contract be assessed by reference to the sum that the claimant could hypothetically have received in return for releasing the defendant from the obligation which he failed to perform? It made clear that negotiating damages should only be used in exceptional circumstances. For example, that damages based on a hypothetical negotiation between the parties can still be appropriate where a defendant has taken something for nothing, for which the complainant was entitled to require payment. Breaches of restrictive covenants are referred to as one of the potentially relevant scenarios where such damages may apply.
At 7, in June, the Court of Appeal gave judgment in First Tower Trustees Limited versus CDS Superstores International Limited, a case dealing with misrepresentation. The key issue was whether non-reliance clauses are exclusion clauses, a matter about which there had been considerable uncertainty. The Misrepresentation Act 1967 provides that contractual provisions that seek to prevent liability for misrepresentation shall be of no effect, except insofar as they are reasonable. The tenant, which trades as The Range, sought to hold its landlord to account for statements made in replies to inquiries about warehouse premises, in which the landlord stated it was unaware of any environmental problems relating to the property. The landlord was advised that there was a problem with asbestos weeks later, but said nothing to the tenant before completing the lease. The tenant was unable to occupy the premises until the asbestos was removed, and sought damages in the sum of £1.4 million. The court had to decide if the landlord was liable to the tenant for misrepresentation or entitled to rely on a provision in the lease stating that "this lease has not been entered into in reliance wholly or partly on any statement or representation made by or on behalf of the landlord." The landlord claimed that this was not in fact an exclusion clause, and so did not have to be reasonable. But the court ruled that this non-reliance clause in the lease was an exclusion clause, and found that it was unreasonable. Therefore, the landlord was liable for misrepresentation. Claire Harmon-Clark, senior professional support lawyer at Taylor Wessing, explained that the case illustrates how liability can arise as a matter of law, independently of what parties have agreed by contract.
At 6, a November decision of the Supreme Court, Regency Villas Title Limited versus Diamond Resorts Europe Limited, which dealt with an area of easements governed by the oft-cited 1956 case Re-Ellenborough Park. It established that residents of timeshare complex Regency Villas had the right to continue using neighbouring sporting and leisure facilities, including a golf course, squash courts, croquet lawn, free of charge, and in so doing, recognised that recreational rights can constitute an easement. In the words of Alison Colby, EG's legal notes and practice point editor, "The case breaks new ground, far beyond that established in Re-Ellenborough Park. The nature of the recreational and sporting facilities in question was much greater, their extent was wider, and the facilities needed intensive management. But recreational rights are recognised as easements in other parts of the world, and the Supreme Court decided by a majority that whatever the attitude in the past, recreational and sporting activity is so clearly a beneficial part of modern life that the law should support structures that promote it, rather than treating them as devoid of practical utility or benefit. Furthermore, easements can be exercised over chattels or fixtures, as well as over land itself." Tim Reed, senior associate at Hogan Lovells International, did, however, sound a note of caution. While the Supreme Court has confirmed that an easement for sports and recreation is capable of being granted, it will often be difficult to prove that the right in question meets all the criteria for creating a binding easement. The judgment made it clear that the factual circumstances are as important to the decision as the underlying legal principles. The rights claimed must have all the requisite characteristics of an easement, and that can be quite difficult to prove when it comes to enjoying rights of sport or recreation. It's also important to stress that on the facts of this case, the express right to use the sports facilities in and around the Mansion House at Broome Park has been a major selling point when the timeshare apartments were being marketed in the early 1980s, and the extent of the rights, that is, use of all the sporting and recreational facilities on the neighbouring land, was clear from the outset, even if it included the right to use facilities that had not yet been built. Again, this will not always be the case when looking at rights.
In at number 5, we have a new entry. A very new entry, in fact, handed down by the Supreme Court only this morning. UKI Kingsway Limited versus Westminster City Council. It's a significant case in relation to the service of documents in the arena of business rates. And the Supreme Court has allowed an appeal by the Billing Authority, Westminster, and ruled that a completion notice handed to a receptionist was properly served even though the receptionist was not employed by the intended recipient. This was because the receptionist scanned and emailed it to UKI, and the decision has been greeted as a vote of confidence in electronic communications from the country's highest court. Liability for non-domestic rates depends on a property being entered as a hereditament in the rating list, and for an unoccupied building to be brought into that list, a completion notice must be served by the Billing Authority. In January 2009, UKI began the redevelopment of One Kingsway, and then in March 2012, Westminster delivered a completion notice by hand to the building, specifying 1st of June 2012 as the completion date. It was addressed to Owner, One Kingsway, London, and given to a receptionist employed by the building manager, who scanned and emailed a copy of the notice to UKI. UKI and Westminster disagreed over whether this constituted valid service, with UKI being successful in the Court of Appeal. However, today, the Supreme Court unanimously ruled in favour of Westminster. Lord Carnwath said that the real issue was whether the Council caused the notice to be received by UKI, and that, in the circumstances of this case, it had, confirming that there was no good reason for distinguishing transmission by fax from transmission by email, as had occurred in this case. Roger Cohen, partner at Brian Cave Leighton Paisner, said, "The Supreme Court has seen the future, and it works." In deciding that the completion notice had been validly served because it reached the developer by email, the justices have affirmed modern methods of communication, so this is a vote of confidence in electronic communications, as well as a lifeline for a billing authority that otherwise would have suffered a material loss of income. Roger came in to discuss the case following the hearing of the appeal last month.
At 4, another rating case, Cardtronics Europe Limited versus Sykes VO. In which the Court of Appeal determined that ATM sites at retail properties were not rateable separately from the host store. It was a case with potentially huge financial ramifications that centred on an appeal of the Valuation Office's decision to list the sites of all cash machines as separate hereditaments for rating purposes. The Upper Tribunal sided with the Valuation Office and concluded that cash machine sites were capable of constituting separate hereditaments. The Court of Appeal, however, disagreed and found that the retailers had not parted with possession of the cash machine sites in any of these cases. They shared occupation with the banks, but remained in possession and retained general control in contractual, physical and functional terms. It is worth noting that we may not have seen the end of this story. EG understands that an appeal is currently under consideration by the Supreme Court.
Now, number 3, and at this time of year, relativity sounds like a measure of how many extended family members we can pretend to like at Christmas. But back in January, it was the word on everyone's lips, as the Court of Appeal ruled on the method of valuing the premiums to be paid for lease extensions and collective enfranchisements. Billions of pounds were said to be at stake in the case of Mundy versus the trustees of the Sloane Stanley estate, in which leaseholder Adrian Mundy claimed that the traditional method has meant that landlords have been overpaid for years. With no small body of support behind him, he advocated use of a new mathematical model for calculating relativity, known as the Parthenia model. However, the Court of Appeal dismissed his appeal, upholding an earlier ruling in which the Upper Tribunal famously referred to the Parthenia model as the clock that strikes 13. Jeremy Hudson, partner at law firm Charles Russell Speechley's, welcomed the clarity of the court's decision, even if he accepted that tenants may be disappointed that the Parthenia model, so favourable to them, has been decisively rejected. Writing for our Legal Notes column, James Driscoll was not surprised by the decision, but shared the view that many might be disappointed that Parthenia had failed to make any headway, particularly as it could have resulted in lower premiums being paid in many claims. Salvation may be at hand, however, as the Law Commission has this year carried out a consultation on leasehold reform, aimed at simplifying and streamlining the enfranchisement process and reducing the costs. However, with any reduction in premiums likely to be vigorously opposed by landlords, it remains to be seen how well the Commission's proposals will be implemented, if at all. It's certainly one of the key issues to watch out for in 2019.
Taking the penultimate spot is a case that we mentioned in 2017's roundup as one to watch out for in 2018. The combined appeal in Dreamvar UK Limited versus Mishcon de Rea and P&P Property Limited versus Owen White and Catlin LLP was determined in May by the Court of Appeal and concerned liability for victims of conveyancing fraud. In both cases, a fraudulent seller made off with the would-be purchaser's funds, leaving the courts to grapple with the question of how the victims can recover their losses. In both Dreamvar and P&P Property, the parties sought to recover the proceeds of sale from third parties. In the case of Dreamvar, this was from its solicitor, Mishcon de Rea, and in P&P Property, from the vendor's solicitor, Owen White and Catlin LLP. In our news write-up of the case, Jerome O'Sullivan, partner at law firm Healy's, who acted for Dreamvar throughout, said that the ruling made it clear that the solicitors acting for a vendor are in the best position to carry out due diligence checks on the seller's true identity and actual ownership of the property concerned. He said, "This case has significant implications for all solicitors dealing with property transactions, their insurers, and all matters where funds are held on client account in relation to any other transactions, such as company acquisitions. It is good news for buyers who are victims of identity fraud. The Court of Appeal has confirmed that the vendor solicitor is in the best position to carry out reasonable due diligence in investigating to verify the vendor's identity and ownership of the property for sale. For practical and regulatory reasons, the purchaser's solicitor is not in a position to carry out such checks." He said that the Court of Appeal had now made it clear that if the vendor's solicitor does not carry out such checks or carries out them negligently, it will have potential liabilities to the purchaser as breaches of warranty of authority, trust or undertaking. He added, if the original judgment had been upheld, it would mean that even if a seller's solicitor was grossly negligent, they would still have no liability to the defrauded purchaser. In contrast, the purchaser's solicitor was left likely to be held solely liable for breach of trust, even if they had not been negligent.
And so we reach the end of our countdown, with another recent decision given at the start of December. We could say that it went straight in at number one, and yet, in a different way, we could also say it has risen five places. Last year, we named the High Court decision of Mr. Justice Jay in S. Francis Limited versus Cavendish Hotel London Limited at number six in our list, describing it as one of the most discussed cases of the year. As Ben Faulkner of Wilberforce Chambers, who acted as junior counsel for the tenant, put it back then, opinion is divided. Some practitioners consider it entirely unremarkable, others view it as the end of the Landlord and Tenant Act 1954 as we know it. This year, excitement for the case only grew as a rarely granted leapfrog appeal took it straight to the Supreme Court in October, and the justices wasted little time in reaching a major decision, allowing the tenant's appeal in what Lord Sumption himself called a remarkable case. The battleground was ground F of section 30 brackets 1 of the Act, and a landlord's right to refuse a new lease where it wishes to redevelop. Here, the evidence was that the landlord's motive for redevelopment was solely to get rid of the tenant, and the High Court judge found that the requisite intention nevertheless existed. Lord Sumption said that the appeal did not turn on the landlord's motive or purpose, nor on an objective assessment of the reasonableness of the proposed scheme of works, but on what it is that the landlord must intend if ground F is to apply. He said, ground F assumes that the landlord's intention to demolish or reconstruct the premises is obstructed by the tenant's occupation. It follows that the landlord's intention to carry out the works cannot be conditional on whether the tenant chooses to assert his claim to a new tenancy. The intention to demolish or reconstruct the premises must exist independently of the tenant's statutory claim to a new tenancy. On the facts, the tenant's possession of the premises did not obstruct the landlord's intended works, and the landlord did not intend to carry them out if the tenant persuaded the court that the works could reasonably be carried out while he remained in possession. Giving general guidance, Lord Sumption said that landlords sometimes plan to carry out work, but inflate the amount of work planned in order to satisfy the Act and get the tenant out. In such cases, judges should only consider the amount of works that the landlord unconditionally plans when considering whether those works satisfy the conditions of the Act. Once again, the case got people talking, and we had no shortage of experts offering us their views. Chris Sullivan of surveying firm Malcolm Hollis, who advised the hotel in the case, said the ruling could cause problems for landlords. "Except for getting a slightly higher rent, I really don't see why anyone would grant a 54 Act lease now," he said. He added that when seeking to gain vacant possession, landlords are now going to have to get their ducks in a row from day one, as proving you meet the demands of the Act is now going to become really difficult. Last week, Joanne Wicks QC and Ben Faulkner of Wilberforce Chambers, who acted successfully for S. Francis, joined us to discuss the court's decision.
Landlords who have genuine plans for redevelopment have absolutely nothing to fear. And there are lots and lots of those landlords out there, and they can use Ground F and they don't have to worry about it. Clearly, what solicitors are going to have to advise their landlord clients is that they're going to have to be cautious about not only doing things which are in fact designed to get the tenant out, but also things that might look like they're designed to get the tenant out.
That completes our rundown of the top 10 property cases of the year. Thank you for listening, and please do have a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year from all of us at EG.